Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The dueling pressers. You know, there's always that conversation about how important is that introductory presser? How important is it to win the introductory presser? Kind of depends on your point of view. Let's break this down, though, because after a flurry of NFL head coaching announcements, we finally do get the pressers. Now, to a lot of people who are yelling about who won the press conference and how much that matters, let me start with Matt Rhule. He definitely brought some passion to his. And his press conference also included this detail from owner David Tepper. Tepper, GM, Marty Herney, and communications director Stephen Drummond flew to Texas so they can meet with Rhule. Now, Rhule and his wife Julie and their kids were just returning from a vacation in Cabo. The Panthers contingency pulls into the driveway behind the family. Well, let me let Tepper pick up the story from there.
He was in his shorts and Mexico t-shirt or whatever. I don't know if he had a suntan or what, but I helped him in with the luggage a little bit. And then Julie had all this food out there, which was just too much food, you know, so she was just feeding us this stuff. And Marty Herney had about 25 meatballs there, just as an aside.
Just as an aside. All right, first things first, what I need to know is, did Rhule keep his shorts and his, quote, Mexico t-shirt on for the interview? Or did he change back into one of his famous smocks? And was it a practice smock? Or was it a game day smock? Or was it one of his formal smocks? I mean, after all, dude was sitting down for the most important job interview of his entire life. Personally, I hope that he stayed in his beach wear because that'd be awesome. Nearly as awesome as Tepper saying that Herney had 25 meatballs. Are you kidding me about that? I haven't heard of an eating display like that since Papa John was bragging on how he murdered 40 of his own pizzas in about 30 days. I'm not sure how anybody could survive 40 of those particular pies in 40 years, much less in 30 days. But if the papa says it so, it must be so.
40 pizzas in 30 days.
40 pizzas in 30 days. It was that slow-mo when I need it, Alvin. The Papa John slow-mo. Then again, this is the same dude who recently said that my main man, Mark Shapiro, should be in jail. Oh, okay, John. The same dude who bum-rushed our Super Bowl set looking for free pub back in the day. Thank you, Alvin. But I digress. Back to the Panthers presser. There were some other good stories, too, coming out of that thing. Like Herney saying, quote, I can't stress this enough. Gets off the plane, goes in the driveway, sits in the dining room, and he's just instant energy. After an hour and a half, they're right. I just said, oh, man, I got to turn him. We got to try to convince this guy that Carolina's the place for him because he was just very impressive, end quote. You want to impress that guy. You want to convince that guy. Just put a $60 million check in front of him. And they did, and it worked. And now reportedly other NFL owners are pissed off about that. Back to that in a minute. Meantime, Rhule was telling about the reaction that his son Bryant had to the whole thing. Once the Panthers brass left, then the kid rolled up on his old man.
My son came downstairs and he said, are we going to Carolina? I said, no. And he stormed, this is a true story, and I stormed out of the house. He said, you had one job, like he wanted to be here, so.
Good one, coach. You can hear the energy though, right? I see why this guy got their attention. And as you can see, the Carolina presser had one great story after another. I mean, that was fun. That's how you win the presser. Meanwhile, the Cowboys had a presser of their own, and they introduced Mike McCarthy. And there were stories, all right, but they weren't great stories. In fact, these stories were nearly impossible to follow. Ever since McCarthy was named as their guy, there's been one report after another that makes that dynamic between Jerry and Mike seem just a little bit, I don't know, whack?
That's whack.
It's weird. It's weird. There was that report of the slumber party, the sleepover. There was the report that their connection was, quote, like love at first sight. And now there is this from Jerry. Jerry explaining why McCarthy is now the Dallas Cowboys head coach.
My sister explained to my dad one time when she was explaining why she wanted to divorce.
And Dad loved her husband, and he said, "What's gotten into you?" And she said, "I don't hear bells." He said, "Bells? I hadn't heard bells for the last 30 years. What's that got to do with it?" Well, the bottom line is that's a dad trying to advise his daughter on the right move. The bottom line is I heard bells.
The hell is Tom Thibodeau doing there? The hell is that old man talking about? I mean, seriously, the hell is everybody laughing at? You heard bells. Did you also smell burnt toast? Hey, Jay, are you sure you're not having a stroke? I mean, seriously, where was he going with that story? You're having a press conference. You're introducing your new head coach. Why are you telling us a story about your sister getting divorced and what Dad thought about that? And could that story have been any more convoluted? Hey, tell me this, Gramps. Tell me this. How many mosquitoes did you have to circumcise in order to get this deal done with McCarthy?
Circumcising the mosquito.
I mean, I know there were, quote, two bottom lines and a ton of bells, but I still have no idea what the hell he was talking about. What does Jerry's sister and her divorce have to do with Mike McCarthy getting hired? Anybody know? Anybody at all? Like, with each passing day, Jarrah makes less and less sense. So I can't help with that. I heard bells. Crap. I heard bells. Did you see dead people too, Jarrah? And his kid, sitting to the side, grinning hysterically throughout the entire proceeding, did not help matters. And how about this one from Jarrah? Jarrah went on and said this.
You got a choice. You can get in that foxhole with somebody that hadn't been shot at, hadn't ever been in a foxhole. You can get in there with somebody that's been shot at. Or you can get in there with somebody that's been shot at and hit and still going. Now that's one I won't in there with.
Yeah, so I'm reading this right, Jarrah. You just hired a head coach who's currently bleeding out in a foxhole. I mean, don't they have to be in like some crazy, fiery car wreck where they get their head cut off too before you know they're worth anything at all? I mean, this whole thing about that foxhole stuff, I think it's high time that everybody involved in sports stopped with all the war metaphors and all the war analogies. I mean, you're not soldiers. This is not war. It's a game. You're not in a foxhole on the front line in Europe. You're wearing a suit in a luxury suite. So why don't we just dial back all the military rhetoric? And Jerry, though, was not alone in telling stories that didn't go anywhere. He was not alone in telling stories that didn't make any sense. Michael had one of his own.
Jerry's telling a story about the purchase of the Dallas Cowboys. And at the end of the story, he leans over to me and he grabs me by the forearm and reaches out to shake my hand. He says, "And you need to be the coach of the Dallas Cowboys." So I jumped up and hugged him, but and I'll stop right there. We had a hell of a time. That's a moment. That's a
Tibbs
moment. And that's
back.
A story I'll be telling the rest of my life.
Tibbs is back. I just don't know what he's doing at that presser. Yeah, I got to be honest, fellas. I'm having a hard time following either one of you. So McCarthy is saying that Jarrah was telling him a story about buying the Cowboys. And then at the end of that story, he told Mike that he should be the head coach. And then they hugged it out. And that's a moment that Mike will never forget. Yeah, I guess as much as a moment as you can have if it involves some super rich old guy and some unemployed middle-aged guy hugging it out during a slumber party. Yeah, to me, here's the big takeaway from that presser and from everything that's come out since this whole deal came together and went down. My big takeaway is Jarrah and Mike like each other. There's some real infatuation there. Like, I'm shocked that Mike didn't go with, "Hey, Jarrah, you had me at circumcised mosquito."
Circumcising the mosquito.
Just as I'm shocked that Jerry didn't have he and Mikey put on their towels and head down through the dressing room, kind of like spanking themselves as if they were emulating riding a horse. I mean, that's what Ezekiel Elliott does. And in Jerry's own words, that's the type of thing that makes him an asset on and off the field.
You know what's fun? Sometimes Zeke will do something like that. He'll put a towel on or he'll put some shorts on or something and head down through the middle of the dressing room kind of spanking himself as he emulates the riding the horse. And that's before a game. So you can see what a asset he is on and off the field to the Dallas Cowboys.
Because he puts on a towel and spanks himself? That makes him an asset. Man, that gets more and more weird every time I hear it. Right, Tibbs? Are you craving some protein after a good workout? If so, do not make a shake this time. Don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire, and it goes wherever you go. To the game, to the gym, to the beach. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? So really, I don't understand anything that Jarrett is rambling on about these days, but I do see him working. As much as we are all on the clock, Jarrett truly is running out of time. Running out of time to win a Super Bowl and probably running out of time on life. This is why this guy was so hell-bent on finding somebody who has experience, who has already won the big one. Somebody who he thinks can return this team to prominence quickly, as opposed to rolling the dice on a hot college coach who's got to learn the process. I get that. I also get McCarthy spending all of the past year reinventing himself and his process and his approach and going to school on the things that got him fired in Green Bay. Maybe Mike has changed. Maybe McCarthy has innovated. Maybe he will kill his second chapter the way Andy Reid is in Kansas City after he left Philadelphia. Or you know what? Maybe McCarthy is not Reid. Maybe Jarrett won't be able to help himself, and he is going to meddle and interfere and not let McCarthy do what he needs to do in order to be successful. I really do not know what's going to happen. I just know this. I need these dudes to stop having sleepovers, stop talking about hearing bells, stop getting dusty at their pressers. Oh, and most of all, they need to stop circumcising mosquitoes.
Circumcising the mosquito.
Which is hope they look better on the field than they do at the dais, because they looked and sounded awkward as hell.
Awkward?
Man, I haven't seen this much heart-wrenching bonding and waterworks since Two had his slingers back in the day.
It's my team. It's my quarterback. And if you guys do that, man, it's unfair. We lost as a team.
Hell, who am I to judge? Crying is caring in the Big D. I'm talking about Torrey Holt. Torrey, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim. It's always good to chat with you, man.
You too, Torrey. Listen, before we talk about the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I want to ask you, Torrey, about the College Football Hall of Fame. You and I spoke at the Super Bowl last year after it had been announced that you were going in, but last month, you and the rest of the class officially were inducted. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, my goodness. It was unbelievable, and the class of guys, the 2019 class, College Football Hall of Fame class, was unbelievable. London Fletcher, part of that class. You know, I won the Super Bowl with London and St. Louis, played against him, played with him. Vince Young was in that class. Rocket Ishmael was in that class. Just unbelievable to be around guys that I grew up watching or, you know, idolizing and playing against. And now being, you know, we were all in one room being inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. And there's so many guys that's played the game of football, played college football, and to be, you know, just that small percentage to be recognized as a College Football Hall of Famer was an unbelievable feeling. Jim, I had so many emotions. I went through so many ranges of emotion, starting back to when I grew up in Gibsonville, North Carolina, to my time in Hargrave Military Academy, to NC State, to the St. Louis Rams, then the Jacksonville Jaguars, a short stint with the New England Patriots. You know, all those memories and emotions came up. So really, I was really, really humbled and fortunate to be able to represent my hometown of Gibsonville and to represent NC State in the College Football Hall of Fame. I was the sixth player, I think, in NC State's history to be inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. So very humbling experience, but really good because I love the game of football, and just to be amongst football lore, it was incredible. It was incredible.
We were talking to Torrey Holt. You know, one more guy, Torrey, is part of that class, and I had him on this show recently, Terrell Buckley. Did you spend any time rapping with T-Buck? My man.
Hey, I love T-Buck, man. You know, when I was getting ready, as I was going in, I took down all the guys' names, and I'm looking for it now, but I can't find it. But I took down all their names, read up on them, wrote down some significant stats and all that. And Terrell Buckley, ladies and gentlemen, 50 interceptions, Jim, in pro football.
Well,
unbelievable. But we played against him. You know, he was with the Denver Broncos. And that was one thing about Terrell Buckley. He was going to take away slants. He was going to take away hitches. He was really going to eliminate your quick game because he had a really good sense forward, and then he had unbelievable quickness and then trust. Like, he trusted himself in terms of what he saw. Well, he picked us off on Monday night, and there's me chasing him down. And that's why I told him at the Hall of Fame ceremony. I'm still chasing you. I said, I still had forgot that interception. So I still owe T-Buck one, but he's an incredible player. And now he's doing a good job of coaching out at Mississippi State.
That's a great story. Torrey Holtz joining us. Now, Torrey, last week the 15 finalists were announced for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What did it mean to you to see your name on that list?
Once again, a whelm of emotions, just starting out again when I played ball in Pop Warner. And Jim, I never said to myself young like that, and even through college, and heck, even through the pros, man, I'm going for the Hall. For me, it was getting an opportunity to do what I love ever since a child, and be around great men to help me, great coaches to help me. Playing consistently for a number of years to be able to master the craft, the art of playing the wide receiver position, and watching guys like Art Monk and Tim Brown and Jerry Rice and, Andre Reed, all of the great guys. And now being able to Terrell Owens, Randy Moss, Icy Bruce, list goes on and on, Marvin Harrison, Jimmy Smith. Now I'm being recognized with the elite of the elite in terms of guys who played in the National Football League. So it's, again, humbling, super excited, though, if you can't tell, super excited. But a great class of guys that I'm with in the 2020 class, Troy Polamalu, Edrin James, who we were drafted in the same year. He's fantastic as well. Zach Thomas, Brian Young, Richard Seymour. I can go all day, but a tremendous class of guys, again, that I admired, played against, battled against, had some great competitions against John Lynch. I was telling a story the other day on my Instagram page about John Lynch and how he would, when he would come out of the, when we would watch film, he would come out of the, he would strike into the film like he was shot out of a missile. Like, that's the kind of aggression that he played with. So John Lynch and Steve Atwater, Leroy Butler, a great group of men that I'm associated with in terms of the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Torrey Holt is a Pro Football Hall of Fame finalist. He's already in the College Football Hall of Fame. Hey, Torrey, one more thought about that. Like, in the past, you said that you'd taken the approach that if it happens, it happens. But yep. Then you had a conversation with Tom Mack, the former great Ram. What did he tell you, and then how did that impact you?
No, he said to me, you're here now. You're being recognized in that light. Because I think Tom had to wait some time, I think, as well. And he said, to keep fighting, to keep your name, your story, keep your legacy alive. And you can do that in a respectable manner. And I think I've done that, and I took his advice. And since then, I just kept fighting. And, when there was opportunities for me to state my case, I took advantage of those and tried to come across as respectful as I could. And now, Jim, I'm here. I'm a finalist. So, regardless of what I said up to this point, now that I'm in here, it's like none of that really matters. It's just being a finalist in itself for such an elite class, and I'm sure there's folks that would say there's a Hall of Famers better than there's some out there that's more worthy of Hall of Fame than Torrey Holt, and I'm pretty sure there is. But I'm here now, and I'm excited about it, and hopefully in February I'll be hearing my name called. Getting inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
We are talking to Torrey Holt, and to a large extent, Torrey, it's kind of out of your hands. I mean, you can make your point,
yeah.
But at the same time, like, when I'm looking at the other pieces that you had on the Rams team, in particular on offense, Kurt Warner, Orlando Pace, Marshall Faulk, Isaac Bruce, you mentioned, do you think that in some ways that as great as that was and as amazing as those teams were, then maybe that gets held against you and you're overlooked as a result? In other words, if you had the kind of production that you had and you put up the numbers for a different team, do you feel like maybe not only would you be under consideration, but you might already be in the Hall of Fame?
Correct. And Jim, that's right. I mean, I often think about that because, look, I was fortunate enough to come into the situation drafted to the St. Louis Rams with all the guys that I played with, and it helped my career tremendously. But I had that same attitude that I had in St. Louis, I would have had somewhere else. And I think I would have been as successful, though, if I would have been drafted to another club. But it is what it is, and I had no control over that. For me, I was sixth overall. I went in and I played like a sixth overall draft pick should play for a long period of time. And I was doing it with a group of guys that were older than I was, Jim. That's the other thing. Those guys were, you know, I was a young buck, but I was playing at such an elite level early on for so long. I think that got lost. I think people took that for granted. And then with such star power and the names that you mentioned, Marshall and Isaac and Kurt and Orlando Pace, it was kind of like, you know, I had to wait my turn, but that was okay. I was cool with that. My thing was, I got to take care of my job. I got to make sure that I'm showing up every practice, showing up every Sunday, and I'm producing. And I was able to do that, and I was able to do it for a long period of time with those guys and without some of those guys.
And, Tony, one more thought about that. Quick follow-up, because you had more receiving yardage in your first five seasons in the NFL than anybody else in the history of the sport. It's supposed to take receivers, Tori, a year or two or more before they can really master the craft at the NFL level. Yeah. How were you able to come into the league and have the immediate impact that you did?
Well, I would say this. I was coached well in college. Coach Kaiser, our offensive coordinator, did a good job of moving me around, challenging me. Coach Fisher was awesome as well. My senior year, I had Daryl Moody as well. So I had some good coaches, guys that taught me and held me accountable, going out and practicing and studying tape and preparing myself for the game. So thanks to my college coaches. And then when I went to the pros, I had examples. You know, I saw Isaac every day. I saw Ricky Prohl every day. I saw Arthur King every single day. I saw Marshall every day. Coach Saunders was our receiver coach, was fantastic in the way he drove us and had us confident to go out and pursue our goals and dreams and really maximize our potential as wide receivers. So great situation there. And then my own individual talents. Funny, I was on Instagram the other day and someone said, Tori, man, you were just better than guys. And you just had, you know, more God-given ability. And he's absolutely right. I was better than guys. I had more God-given ability than a lot of guys. But I also had the work ethic, Jim. The drive to want to be good at football and my position, but not only that, also being a good teammate, you know, rallying the troops when I needed to, you know, being there, showing up in big games, that mattered. So I think that's where I got it from, and that was what drove me for 11 years in the National Football League to try to play at a very, very high level.
Tori, last thought, that drive. I'm always curious about this. Where did the drive come from? Were you wired for it? Was it always like that? Is that the way you always remember it? Or was it something you were able to manufacture?
Yeah, when it came down to sports, Jim, I had the drive. I'll show up at any park. I'll go anywhere to play. I just wanted to compete. I knew early on that I had the ability to play sport and play it well. My uncles did it. My aunties did it. My dad did it. My mom was athletic. So it was in me. And then growing up here in North Carolina, seeing guys like David, hearing about guys and seeing guys like David Thompson and Michael Jordan and James Worthy and Lawrence Taylor. I mean, I grew up around greatness, man, in sports. So it's just always been a part of me. And once I figured out that I could actually do this and do it for a living, you know, as I got older and make some money, I was like, shit, I got a chance to be great at this. I got the resources. I have the ability. I have a platform to do it. So why not go out and make the most of it with my teammates? Won championships, impacted the game on so many levels. I'm excited about it. Really, really thrilled about where our game is going and still having an opportunity to be associated with the National Football League. It's really cool.
He is a member of the College Football Hall of Fame class of 2019. He is also a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, a Super Bowl champ, a 7-time Pro Bowler. He is Tori Holt. Tori, I love the energy. It's always great to get caught up with you. Congrats on that induction. I'll be watching you for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it's always good to have you on the show. Tori, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jim, as always. All the best, man.
All right, so it's been a minute or so since Jimmy Butler has been a topic on this show, which makes me a little bit sad. But Jimmy Butler is a topic on the show today because of what went down last night. Miami v. Indiana was not about Heat v. Pacers. Instead, it was about Jimmy Butler v. TJ Warren. Now, if I'm being honest, before last night, I really didn't know that Jimmy Butler and TJ Warren was a thing. But it's definitely a thing right now. In the third quarter of last night's game, Butler had the ball, and then, well, yeah, what the hell? Just go ahead and roll it.
When this is a rare, there's some words between Butler and Warren. They have to be separated.
It wasn't just words. It was about to be more than this. This was going to be more than that. I don't think, I mean, the officials will probably look at it. They got to calm TJ down. Both of them got to calm down. Calm down. And the officials will take a look at it.
Yeah, you tell Jimmy Butler to calm down. Yeah, good luck with that. Now, that was a hardish foul, but certainly not the hardest foul ever. I mean, far from it. But Butler did not like it at all, especially that part where Warren grabbed him by the arm and spun him around. And then Butler got right into Warren. They were separated, but that did not stop them from bumping their gums and jawing at each other. There were a lot of obscenities and a great camera shot of Butler yelling, quote, "You're bleeping trash," at Warren. "You're bleeping trash." He was also yelling, "I'm tough." And then Warren appeared to gesture that they should just take it outside. You know, step outside, which is pretty awesome. Well, awesome if you enjoy two supremely conditioned world-class athletes and alphas threatening to give each other the hands in front of nearly 20,000. Or even if they didn't do that, but instead met in the tunnel leading back to the locker room or on the loading dock in their streets. I mean, now we're getting somewhere, right? Except never came to that. Instead, we had double T's, which were handed out, and then it looked like cooler heads were going to prevail. Luckily, that's not what happened. Not at all. In fact, not even for a second. It didn't last a second before it sparked up once again, because one play later, this is what happened.
And Warren right back on Butler. Oh, Jimmy. Put a shoulder into the chest of Warren, and then Warren just got himself tossed out of the game for taunting. Well, neither player showing much in the way of poise right there. Oh, my.
Well, what's going to happen?
I don't know if you saw that on TV or not, but TJ Warren, that is a no-no, my friend.
And that's why Warren's going to be tossed right now. This is his second technical foul. This is why it's so important that they call those first technical fouls. They have no toleration at all. And TJ Warren, who's the leading scorer for the Indiana Pacers.
I like that part about how neither player is, quote, showing much poise. Yeah, but they're both showing a lot of awesome. Just to recap the visuals on that, Warren draws an offensive foul on Butler, and then immediately starts to clap in Jimmy's ears. He gets tossed for that, but he's still jawing with Jimmy, and then Butler starts blowing kisses to him to say goodbye. And then as he's leaving, Warren flips him off, lobs him the board, or the bird, which is outstanding, like excellent work all the way around. Because it's not like the Pacers and Heat are traditional rivals. It's not like we give a damn about that matchup. I mean, sure, back in the day when Roy Hibbert and Paul George were taking on the Heatles, there may have been some fire back then. But that had long ago since gone out. So we don't have that anymore. Not when guys are getting into it, though, on the court. Now we've got guys yelling at each other, clapping in each other's ears, blowing each other kisses, flipping each other off, and calling each other bleeping trash, and calling each other out to take it outside. And even then it wasn't done, because Butler had thoughts after the game, and those thoughts were incredible. Initially, it sounded like he might be somewhat sympathetic towards Warren.
To me, I think it's tough for him because I can guard him and he can't guard me. Like, at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. But like I said, I think you just got to watch your mouth in certain situations. There's something you just don't say as a man. And, he got to see me the next time, because I feel like what he said was truly disrespectful. And it's all good because we see him again. I ain't scared of nobody. So, you know, he talking about, oh, we're going to fight this, that. It is what it is to me.
And then what did you notice, the middle finger from him, and was the blowing of the kiss?
He's not even in the league, like nowhere near me. And if I was their coach, I would never put him on me ever again. He's like, no, put somebody else on me, because I'm a tad up every time we play. So he's trash. Sort of
such gold. Man, that is gold. That is so, so good. Like, what's your favorite part of that whole thing? I ask because I don't even know what mine is. There is so much good stuff in that. There's, quote, he's soft. He's not even in my bleeping league. And then, quote, if I were their coach, I would never put him on me ever again. Like, no, put somebody else on me, because I'm going to tear that ass up every time. End quote. And then the closer. When I say that he's trash, I mean that. He's not in my league, and I take it as disrespect if you ever put him on me. End quote. I'm telling you, I have not seen a guy talk about another guy being trash quite like that since Pac-Man Jones destroyed Terrell Pryor in a post-game interview. You remember that. That's the gold standard right there. That's the bar. That's the thing that everybody is measured against. When Pac-Man was asked about a number or asked a number of questions about Pryor and kept answering, suck, what else? Suck, what else? Then he called him, quote, garbage. And then he grabbed a real trash can, pretended to look for Pryor in the trash can, and yelled, hey, yo, you in there?
I know you're talking
you in there?
Garbage.
What did that start with for you, Terrell?
Garbage.
There you go, right there, bro.
Oh,
there you go.
Get him out of there. You see him in there?
Oh, right there.
You better find him somebody to play with.
Is it him saying basically he could
garbage
you?
Garbage.
Garbage.
All right, aside from Terrell, how big is it for you?
Garbage. I ain't talking about nothing else. I'm happy we won.
All right, cool.
Terrell Pryor, garbage.
All right.
Garbage. My man, Pac. Best trash slash garbage angle ever from a pro athlete.
Garbage.
Jimmy Butler was really good last night, but Pac-Man is still the gold standard. Pulled out a trash can as a prop and was looking inside of it for Pryor and kept cutting off the questioner with garbage. But then there was Butler hopping on Instagram after the game, screenshotting Miami's schedule, circling March 20th in Indy, and then chasing that with the caption, at T Warren 1, don't be mad you can't guard me. We will see what you about in March. End quote. Yeah, we'll see what everyone's about in March. Friday, March 20th, Indy, 7 p.m. Eastern, to quote the great Bartholomew Scott. Can't wait.
Can't wait.
And some of you dopes want to say that the NBA regular season does not matter. Yeah, those games do matter. They matter when Jimmy Butler and TJ Warren are playing. And then they definitely matter when you insult Butler by putting Warren on Butler. And they matter when Butler is calling Warren bleeping trash and blowing kisses at him after Warren flipped him off. My man, never change. Never change, Jimmy. I know you won't, which is awesome. And one more note on this before I go to break. Butler's teammate, James Johnson, is an actual MMA fighter. Like, he's a badass MMA fighter. He's got the nickname Bloodsport. And seriously, he owns an undefeated record in MMA and kickboxing. My man's got a black belt in karate. So my advice to Jay and TJ both, neither one of you, let Bloodsport get involved in this riff. Or it's going to be... It's Nate Diaz. What's up, Nate? I love Nate Diaz. Yo, Nate. I got a message for you, Nate. I'm talking about Torrey Holt. Torrey, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim. As always, good to chat with you, man.
You too, Torrey. Listen, before we talk about the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I want to ask you, Torrey, about the College Football Hall of Fame. You and I spoke at the Super Bowl last year after it had been announced that you were going in. But last month, you and the rest of the class officially were inducted. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, my goodness. It was unbelievable. And the class of guys, the 2019 class, College Football Hall of Fame class, was unbelievable. London Fletcher, part of that class. You know, I won the Super Bowl with London and St. Louis, played against him, played with him. Vince Young was in that class. Rocket Ishmael was in that class. Just unbelievable to be around guys that I grew up watching or, you know, idolizing and playing against. And now being, you know, we were all in one room being inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. And there's so many guys that's played the game of football, played college football, and to be, you know, just that small percentage to be recognized as a College Football Hall of Famer was an unbelievable feeling. Jim, I had so many emotions. I went through so many ranges of emotion, starting back to when I grew up in Gibsonville, North Carolina, to my time in Hargrave Military Academy, to NC State, to the St. Louis Rams, then the Jacksonville Jaguars, a short stint with the New England Patriots. You know, all those memories and emotions came up. So really, I was really, really humbled and fortunate to be able to represent my hometown of Gibsonville and to represent NC State in the College Football Hall of Fame. I was the sixth player, I think, in NC State's history to be inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. So very humbling experience, but really good because I love the game of football and just to be amongst football lore. It was incredible.
We were talking to Torrey Holt. You know, one more guy, Torrey, is part of that class, and I had him on this show recently, Terrell Buckley. Did you spend any time rapping with T-Buck? My man.
Hey, I love T-Buck, man. You know, when I was getting ready, as I was going in, I took down all the guys' names, and I'm looking for it now, but I can't find it. But I took down all their names, read up on them, wrote down some significant stats and all that. And Terrell Buckley, ladies and gentlemen, 50 interceptions, Jim, in pro football.
Well,
unbelievable. But we played against him. You know, he was with the Denver Broncos. And that was one thing about Terrell Buckley. He was going to take away slants. He was going to take away hitches. He was really going to eliminate your quick game because he had a really good sense forward, and then he had unbelievable quickness and then trust. Like, he trusted himself in terms of what he saw. Well, he picked us off on Monday night, and there's me chasing him down. And so I told him at the Hall of Fame ceremony, I'm still chasing you. I said, I still had forgot that interception. So I still owe T-Buck one, but he's an incredible player, and now he's doing a good job of coaching out at Mississippi State.
That's a great story. Torrey Holt's joining us. Now, Torrey, last week the 15 finalists were announced for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What did it mean to you to see your name on that list?
Once again, a whelm of emotions. You know, just starting out again when I played ball in Pop Warner. And Jim, I never said to myself young like that, and even through college, and heck, even through the pros, man, I'm going for the hall. For me, it was getting an opportunity to do what I love ever since a child, and be around great men to help me, great coaches to help me. Playing consistently for a number of years to be able to master the craft, the art of playing the wide receiver position, and watching guys like Art Monk and Tim Brown and Jerry Rice and, you know, Andre Reed, all of the great guys, and now being able to Terrell Owens, Randy Moss, Icy Bruce, this goes on and on, Marvin Harrison, Jimmy Smith. Now I'm being recognized with the elite of the elite in terms of guys who played in the National Football League. So it's, again, humbling, super excited, though, if you can't tell, super excited. But a great class of guys that I'm with in the 2020 class, Troy Polamalu, Edrin James, who we were drafted in the same year. He's fantastic as well. Zach Thomas, Brian Young, Richard Seymour. You know, I can go all day, but a tremendous class of guys, again, that I admired, played against, battled against, had some great competitions against John Lynch. I was telling a story the other day on my Instagram page about John Lynch and how when he would strike into the film like he was shot out of a missile. Like, that's the kind of aggression that he played with. So John Lynch and Steve Atwater, Leroy Butler, just a great group of men that I'm associated with in terms of the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Torrey Holt is a Pro Football Hall of Fame finalist. He's already in the College Football Hall of Fame. And Torrey, one more thought about that. Like, in the past, you've said that you'd taken the approach that if it happens, it happens. But then you had a conversation with Tom Mack, the former great Ram. What did he tell you, and then how did that impact you?
No, he said to me, you know, you're here now. You're being recognized in that light. Because I think Tom had to wait some time, I think, as well. And he said, you know, to keep fighting, you know, to keep your name, your story, keep your legacy alive. And you can do that in a respectable manner. And I think I've done that, and I took his advice. And since then, you know, I just kept fighting. And, you know, when there was opportunities for me to state my case, I took advantage of those and tried to come across as respectful as I could. And now, Jim, I'm here. I'm a finalist. So, you know, regardless of what I said up to this point, now that I'm in here, it's like none of that really matters. It's just being a finalist in itself for such an elite class. And I'm sure there's folks that would say there's a Hall of Famers better than there's some out there that's more worthy of Hall of Fame than Torrey Holt, and I'm pretty sure there is. But I'm here now, and I'm excited about it. And hopefully, in February, I'll be hearing my name called, getting inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
We are talking to Torrey Holt. You know, and to a large extent, Torrey, it's kind of out of your hands. I mean, you can make your point, but at the same time, like, when I'm looking at the other pieces that you had on the Rams team, in particular on offense, Kurt Warner, Orlando Pace, Marshall Faulk, Isaac Bruce, you mentioned. Do you think that in some ways that as great as that was and as amazing as those teams were, then maybe that gets held against you and you're overlooked as a result? In other words, if you had the kind of production that you had and you put up the numbers for a different team, do you feel like maybe not only would you be under consideration, but you might already be in the Hall of Fame?
Correct. And Jim, that's right. I mean, I often think about that because, look, I was fortunate enough to come into the situation, drafted to the St. Louis Rams with all the guys that I played with, and it helped my career tremendously. But I had that same attitude that I had in St. Louis, I would have had somewhere else. And I think I would have been as successful, though, if I would have been drafted to another club. But it is what it is, and I had no control over that. For me, I was 6th overall. I went in and I played like a 6th overall draft pick should play for a long period of time. And I was doing it with a group of guys that were older than I was, Jim. That's the other thing. Those guys were, you know, I was a young buck, but I was playing at such an elite level early on for so long. I think that got lost. I think people could take that for granted. And then with such star power and the names that you mentioned, Marshall and Isaac and Kurt and Orlando Pace, it was kind of like, you know, I had to wait my turn, but that was okay. I was cool with that. My thing was, I got to take care of my job. I got to make sure that I'm showing up every practice, showing up every Sunday, and I'm producing. And I was able to do that. And I was able to do it for a long period of time with those guys and without some of those guys.
And Tony, one more thought about that. Quick follow-up. Because you had more receiving yardage in your first 5 seasons in the NFL than anybody else in the history of the sport. It's supposed to take receivers, Tori, a year or two or more before they can really master the craft at the NFL level. Yeah. How were you able to come into the league and have the immediate impact that you did?
Well, I would say this. I was coached well in college. Coach Kaiser, our offensive coordinator, did a good job of moving me around, challenging me. Coach Fisher was awesome as well. My senior year, I had Daryl Moody as well. So I had some good coaches, guys that taught me and held me accountable, going out and practicing and studying tape and preparing myself for the game. So thanks to my college coaches. And then when I went to the pros, I had examples. You know, I saw Isaac every day. I saw Ricky Prohl every day. I saw Arthur King every single day. I saw Marshall every day. Coach Saunders was our receiver coach, was fantastic in the way he drove us and had us confident to go out and pursue our goals and dreams and really maximize our potential as wide receivers. So great situation there. And then my own individual talent. It's funny, I was on Instagram the other day and someone said, Tori, man, you were just better than guys. And you just had, you know, more God-given ability. And he's absolutely right. I was better than guys. I had more God-given ability than a lot of guys. But I also had the work ethic, Jim. The drive to want to be good at football and my position. But not only that, also being a good teammate, you know, rallying the troops when I needed to, you know, being there, showing up in big games, that mattered. So I think that's where I got it from. And that was what drove me for 11 years in the National Football League to try to play at a very, very high level.
Tori, last thought, that drive. I'm always curious about this. Where did the drive come from? Were you wired for it? Was it always like that? Is that the way you always remember it? Or was it something you were able to manufacture?
Yeah, when it came down to sports, Jim, I had to drive. I'll show up at any park. I'll go anywhere to play. I just wanted to compete. I knew early on that I had the ability to play sport and play it well. My uncles did it. My aunties did it. My dad did it. My mom was athletic, so it was in me. And then growing up here in North Carolina, seeing guys like David, hearing about guys and seeing guys like David Thompson and Michael Jordan and James Worthy and Lawrence Taylor. I mean, I grew up around greatness, man, in sports. So it's just always been a part of me. And once I figured out that I could actually do this and do it for a living, you know, as I got older and make some money, I was like, shit, I got a chance to be great at this. I got the resources. I have the ability. I have a platform to do it. So why not go out and make the most of it? With my teammates, won championships, impacted the game on so many levels. I'm excited about it, really, really thrilled about where our game is going and still having an opportunity to be associated with the National Football League. It's really cool.
He is a member of the College Football Hall of Fame class of 2019. He is also a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, a Super Bowl champ, a 7-time Pro Bowler. He is Tori Holt. Tori, I love the energy. It's always great to get caught up with you. Congrats on that induction. I'll be watching you for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it's always good to have you on the show. Tori, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jim, as always. All the best, man.
Dear Jim. I think Jerry Jones' story about hearing bells makes total sense. Sincerely, Kenny Smith's sandwich analogy. All right, if I'm not mistaken, it's not the sandwich analogy, but rather it was about him driving to Staples back in the day. Keyshawn had the sandwich analogy. Kenny Smith had the, if you and I, Jim, were driving to Staples or the sports arena or whatever it was, wherever the Clippers play, that was his analogy. Quote, wherever the Clippers play.
Jim, if me and you drove from L.A. to down to where the Clippers play down there a game, and they said they're going to give us $100 to do it, and I'm going to look at you and go, hey, Jim, at the end of the day, I drove more than you did. So we're going to negotiate how much each of us get. I think I deserve $60, you deserve $40. I put the gas in, what have you. So on both sides feel that their part is bigger than the other side's part. They think that pumping the gas, so to speak, is more important than driving the car. And then they think that washing the car to get it down there is more. So everyone right now is just saying that their part is so important, and that's why you have these long negotiations and you have this long stalemate.
Well, that was kind of whack. I don't know what that means at all. That was Kenny Smith. Anyway, this guy, Paul in Albany. Paul in Albany says, well, what about Kenny Smith's sandwich analogy? No, Keyshawn had the sandwich analogy, and Kenny Smith had the analogy if he and I were to drive down to where the Clippers play. I don't know. This was Keyshawn on the sandwich.
You killing me, and you ain't even read my book.
Keyshawn, man, I have read the book, and I'm not killing you. I just said you whacked your teammates, and I couldn't believe it.
Did I whack them?
Dude, you whacked them. You called your quarterback a Jake.
Did I call him a Jake?
You called him a faker.
Okay.
Jake is a faker.
Did I say he was really hurt, or did I say I was thinking that one side of me and one other side of me wondered if he was faking for the coaching staff?
I mean, that's calling out a dude's character, man. That's questioning his manhood.
You think so? I don't think so. I think, first of all, you got to read the book. If you haven't read the book, then there's nothing that you can say about it.
Tell me the difference between you wondered in your mind if he might be faking and the guy's a faker. I don't understand the difference there, excerpt, book, or not.
Dude, you asked me that, how can that cross my mind, right? You're asking me how could it cross my mind? How could I wonder whether or not a half a side of me says it's faking? It's like a half a side of you says, should I eat this sandwich or should I not eat the sandwich? But then you decide. You say, oh, well, and you leave it alone.
That was a conversation Keyshawn and I had on this show way back in the day when he had that book. Wild times, right? I also told you the story where Key and I were fine. You know, we had that give and take on that day. But again, he once knocked on my door because he bought his mother a house in the same neighborhood that I lived in the 818. And he came banging on my door one day. And I'm like, yo, Key, what's up? He said, you've been talking bleep about me again, Rome. I said, no, I have not. He said, yes, you have. And I looked him right in the eye. Well, I looked up at him. He's taller than me. I said, Key, I haven't. All right? Like, where are you going now? Where are you going with this? He's like, my boys told me that Jim said this. And he goes on this whole rant about him and somebody else. I don't need to reset. I said, I never even had that conversation. You got the wrong Jim. And we're going back and forth on my porch, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then we did finally flush it out. He had the wrong Jim. It wasn't Jim Rome. And then it was fine. He's like, all right, man. See you later, bro. I'm like, see you later, Key. That conversation that I just played for you was in 1997. Me and Key. Remember that book, Just Give Me the Damn Ball? We are joined by Seth Curry. Seth, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good. I'm great, Seth. So obviously the season is always going to be a grind. It's a long season. But when you're coming off a tough loss to the Nuggets last night, when you have a game like that, Seth, a game that comes down to the last possession, is it something that eats at you for a little bit, or are you able to process that pretty quickly and immediately start to lock in on the Lakers?
I mean, after the night, you come into practice the next day like we did today and try to learn from it and bounce back. But the great thing about the NBA is you usually you got one day off and you got another game where you play it back-to-back. So it never stops moving. You got a next game and another chance to get out there and get a win.
All right, so from the outside, it seems like you really established yourself in the NBA with the Mavericks back in 2016 and 17. Then, of course, you suffered the injury and you missed the next season before going to Portland. So how good does it feel to you to be back in Dallas?
Oh, it feels good, man. It's a city, a fan base, organization I'm comfortable with. Like you said, I have had my best season here thus far here in Dallas. So It's been good to be back, hit the ground running, and be on a good team again. Hopefully, make the playoffs and make a good run. So, I mean, I'm locked into what we're doing this season.
Talking to Seth Curry, you know, if we were to go back to the summer, you were a free agent and the Mavericks made it really clear they wanted you to come back. You and I talked last season when you were in Portland, and it was clear how much that team and that group of guys meant to you as well. So how did you go about approaching your free agency?
I mean, just trying to be open-minded, and it was like the first time in my NBA career where I would be able to decide where I wanted to play. I had a lot of interest in me during the free agency, so I was trying to take it in stride and trying to balance, like you said, the teams that really wanted me and the best situation for me, myself, and my family. And Portland was great, but Dallas is obviously the decision I made for a lot of different reasons.
Now, Seth, I want to take one more step back, too. You and I have talked about the past, everything you had to battle for, and you had to fight for everything that you have in this league. You went undrafted. You put in the work in the D-League. You had time with Cleveland, Memphis, Phoenix, Sacramento, Dallas, and Portland. After coming through all of that, how did it feel then to sign a multi-year contract to come back to Dallas? What was that like?
It felt great. It felt great, man. It's something you work for, especially after coming out of Duke, having an injury and playing in the D-League and just fighting for every opportunity to get meaningful minutes in the NBA. I mean, I'd like to continue to work on my game and make the most out of my opportunities and then be able to finally be at a point where, I mean, I was a wanted commodity in the NBA and people were making known that they wanted my services. And it's just about continuing to get better and keep it going and trying to have a long career.
We're talking to Mavericks player Seth Curry. Now, Seth, rejoining that team meant that you were going to join Luka and Kristaps, who was coming back from injury. Sometimes when you've got new pieces in an offense, it could take a little while for everybody to get on the same page, but you guys are currently second in the division, so it's working. Like, I know there's still plenty of room for improvement, but how have you been able to get on the same page, everybody on the same page so fast?
I mean, we got a lot of talent, a lot of guys that can do a lot of different stuff on the offices, and our pieces fit well together, so as long as we're playing the right basketball, coach put in a good system to fit all of our skill sets. So offensively, we've been pretty much the best in the league. It's about defensively just continue to get better and obviously closing out games in a better fashion than we have been doing lately. So I think just everybody being able to impact the game at a high level in offensive unit was prepared us so far this season.
I mean, Seth, Luka obviously is just something unbelievable. Last month when he made his return from injury in the first game back, you hit him with a behind-the-back pass for a dunk. What's it been like playing with Luka so far?
It's been exciting, man. He's been real consistent offensively this season. For a guy that young to have the load on his shoulders that he does every night and continue to produce and put up big numbers every single night, seeing the defense he faces, he's really impressive, and just like I said, he's getting better every game throughout the season, and as he continues to figure out how to close games, the sky's the limit for him.
We're talking to Seth Curry. Now, Seth, as the league embraces advanced metrics more, your name keeps coming up over and over again because you're a bit of an advanced stats phenomenon. How much attention do you pay to the advanced stats, and what's it mean to you to know that your game is really respected as a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, you hear it from the coaches and the guys that work around the organization, the areas that they want you to shoot the ball and stuff like that. But for me personally, I work on all different types of my areas of my game and trying to take good shots. I think that's the biggest thing for me is take good shots. Obviously, I'm a good shooter, but I don't want to be a high volume, low efficient guy. You know what I'm saying? Be very efficient with my shots, and when I'm out there, that's what I think about. Just trying to affect the game on both ends of the floor, shoot the ball from the perimeter well, get to the free throw line, and finish around the basket, and that makes you an analytics darling, I guess.
Hey, you are an analytics darling, especially around the basket. They love you around the basket. But just so the listeners have a really good idea what we're talking about, Seth, one of the stats that really jumps out is the fact that since 2013, you have the fifth best grade on off-balance shots from 26 feet with a defender within 2 feet. I mean, that's a pretty complicated metric. So what's your reaction when you hear something like that? Is that something you were even aware of? Is that something you would ever think about during a game?
Yeah, that's the first time I heard it, to be honest. So, I mean, I think that's just when you get in a good rhythm and I mean, when we work out in the summer, we work on all different types of shots. And especially being around Steph and our trainers from back home, they really challenge us to make different shots. And even if you're a little off balance and your shoulders are square, to still be able to focus on the rim and make the shot. So I guess that's where it comes from. I'm trying to keep that going.
We're talking to Seth Curry for a couple of more moments. You know, we talked about the talent on the roster. Being back in Dallas means that you're back with God Sham God. I had him on the show last year, man. I absolutely love the conversation. Love talking to him. What's it like to work with Sham God?
Nah, he's great. He's great. He's a real basketball junkie. Obviously, highly respected in the New York area from what he did as a youngster playing in New York City. But, I mean, I work with him every day, and he's helped my game tremendously, just being able to be creative off the dribble. And like I said, finishing around the basket is a lot of stuff we do on a daily basis. So, I mean, Sham God's done a great job for not only me and a lot of different people on our team. So, it's good to see him getting the attention and the respect that he deserves.
You know, Seth, you made the point last month that Kristaps has not played in a while, so people have forgotten about him. As you play with him, how good is he?
He's really good. He's good. He's serious about the game. He works on his body and his game every day. So, I mean, he's going to continue to get better, but he's not nowhere near where he wants to be and where we expect him to be going forward, just coming off that long injury he has. So, I mean, just him being out there and the space he creates for our offense and the way he protects the rim defensively is a huge weapon for us. So, I mean, we need him back seriously.
Hey, Seth, one last thought. You mentioned about he works on his body. You know, we only see the finished product. In terms of approach, what's your approach in terms of working on your body, working on rest, working on recovery, working on nutrition? I mean, how important are all these things and how much work goes into that?
Oh, that's tremendously important. That's just as important as the skill work you put in on the floor every day. I mean, you got to be available to play. You got to take care of your body and consistently do things to prevent injuries. And, I mean, that comes in your off days and pregame, postgame, just icing, eating right, stretching, and lifting weights. And it's really a full-time thing that you can't really take a day off with, or it could catch up to you late in the season.
He is averaging 10 points, 10 rebounds, 2 assists a game. He was a first-team All-ACC-er at Duke. You got Dallas. They're second in the Southwest, and they got a big win tomorrow night at home against the Lakers. Seth Curry, my guest. Seth, great to have you back. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, good talk to you.
Good night now!